move to the last paper for this afternoon's session. It will be presented by Nora Lesserson, who is a graduate student at Harvard in History and Middle Eastern Studies. Prior to that, she completed her undergraduate degree in Religious Studies at Harvard in 2009. She is the author of a recent article on provincial cosmopolitanism, which is the subject of her presentation today, which was recently published in the Journal of Comparative Studies in Society and History. Nora.
Hi, everyone. I know it's the end of a long day. I'm sorry. But thanks so much for including me. I'm very humbled to even be here. I will be talking today. It comes up. This paper, as has been indicated, is actually a condensed version of an article that was recently published. It uses my great-grandfather, Hovhannes Tertian's unpublished memoir, as a primary source to bring to light aspects of late... Okay, well, I remembered what I wanted to say now, which is that I think this takes up very nicely from where we just left off on the panel, so I'm actually happy that the order was reversed. So I'm using my great-grandfather's memoir, Hovhannes Tertian, as a primary source to bring to light aspects of late Ottoman social and cultural history that it's been made quite clear today remain largely unexamined in the current historiography. I will argue that Tertian's vivid accounts of extended social, cultural, and commercial interactions and affiliations between Armenians, Turks, and Arabs in late Ottoman Marash, which are characterized by interpersonal openness, sympathy, intimacy, and pleasure, even as they are presented side by side with descriptions of deportations, dispossession, and death at the hands of the late Ottoman state, is an expression of an unexpected provincial cosmopolitanism that should be accounted for when we seek to imagine, reconstruct, and represent the lived experience of many ordinary Ottoman subjects, actually. And I was actually thinking about this when we're talking about writing a connected history. The interesting thing about doing this through a lens of cosmopolitanism is that there are necessarily others in the anecdotes. And so these become narratives not just of the Armenian involved, but of the other people involved as well, because they're having basically the same experience. So in recent years, there have been a number of critical studies seeking to complicate the way in which late Ottoman non-Muslim life is represented in both academic and popular literature. These new histories aim to debunk established post-Ottoman nationalist historiographies that portray former late Ottoman subject communities like the Greeks, the Jews, and the Armenians as insulated and homogenous proto-nation states, and to posit them instead as heterogeneous and interacting communal bodies that have complex, contextualized, and variable relationships to their neighbors, as well as to imperial power structures. In this paper, I'll be adding to the growing body of work written against the persistence of the model of communal insularity and non-interaction. This model continues to impair our ability to apprehend the real on-the-ground social infrastructure and dynamics of late Ottoman society, and in the present case, specifically, of provincial late Ottoman society. And by province here, I mean not the self-evidently important major port cities, trading cities, administrative capitals, pilgrimage destinations, but a society with a very particular diminutive relationship of province to capital, such as Ottoman Marash. So because of this model of non-interaction, we're not able to feel the social fabric or to recognize the humanity, really, of the late Ottoman historical actors that we're looking for, and we're also unable to fully seek, chart, and apprehend the nature of the interpersonal relationships and networks that propelled late Ottoman life. If you're not looking for it, you can't see it. If you don't think it's there, you can't see it. So this paper will provide one more attempt to excavate intercommunal and interactive elements of late Ottoman provincial society, and it will encourage us to read and analyze the past with a new imagination of what was possible for late Ottoman relationships and identities. So I'm going to skip the part that we've all made very clear, which is that from this sort of critical historiography, the Armenian voice is sort of absent. There are books on the Greeks and the Jews, and sort of they're adding their voice to the conversation. But the Armenian voice thus far, for many reasons we've discussed, is so far absent. We're all clearly working on fixing that. And I'm so proud to be a part of this group. So let's speak about my great-grandfather's memoir. Hovhannes Tertian was born in Marash, this is an image of Marash, in 1886, and he died in New York City in 1967. He lived by the mosque, the Lujami, right in the center of town, which I didn't indicate, but it's on the map in the middle. That's it, and this is another image of Marash. He died in New York City in 1967. He completed the writing of his testimony, which, as he says, is the brief story of his life, about a year before his death in 1966. Spanning 230 pages of handwritten Armenian script, the text primarily describes his experiences in the Ottoman military, his family's subsequent deportation from Marash, his years as a deportee in present-day Syria, his return home after World War I, the last disaster of Marash in 1920, and his visit to Soviet Armenia late in his life. Among such really momentous and tragic testimony, Tarishian's account also includes details of warm and intimate human interactions, of humorous and supportive conversations, of small kindnesses, of generous favors, of food, a lot of wine and apricots and dolma and drink and other revealing glimpses into Ottoman Armenian lived experience. Indeed, notwithstanding his experience of profound suffering and loss during his final years in his native land, and his evidently deep commitment to the Armenian people and their history, reflected only partially in the fact that he dedicates his testimony to the immortal memory of the 2 million innocent Armenians victimized in the Great Catastrophe of 1915. Tarishian's retrospective presentation and valorization of himself as an Armenian living under Ottoman rule in the quite violent years between 1886 and 1920 is anything but a one-dimensional, monovalent testimony of identity as a victim. It's actually quite the opposite. Throughout the text, Tarishian assumes various positions vis-a-vis his identity that at first blush appear to us to be antithetical to his experience as a victim of genocide. As a paramount case, his descriptions of deportation and death at the hands of the late Ottoman state are presented side by side with a number of striking accounts of extended intercommunal interactions, affiliations, and networks characterized by intercommunal and interpersonal openness, sympathy, intimacy, and pleasure, which we're not accustomed to seeing in historiography. Because of its multidimensional nature, Tarishian's testimony offers us a language with which to begin instructively to explore the significance of the lived negotiation of violence and friendship and power that defined at least one man's late Ottoman-Armenian life. A devout Christian and an active participant in Armenian community fairs, Tarishian was nevertheless oriented in an important degree towards intercommunal openness and affiliation, a condition that enabled his many, many social networks and interactions, both improvised and well-established. So this paper will focus on these and afterwards give a note about their implications for further Ottoman study. So this is Tarishian, my mom's actually on the right, and my grandparents in the middle, and my aunt. And that's Hovhannes Tarishian and his wife, his second wife. His first wife actually died, leaving Marash in 1920 with the French, and that's my great-great-grandfather. So some of the most evocative passages in Tarishian's memoir involve his references to a Turkish or Arab contemporary in terms of family and friendship, an act that has also been documented in other works on Ottoman Greeks and Jews and Arabs, and which can be found in the oral and written testimony of other Armenian genocide survivors. Of his relationships with his Arab military commanders during his time in the Ottoman military, for example, Tarishian writes, "The general, Mustafa Enver Bey, treated me lovingly as his own son, in the same manner as my former commanders Omar Efendi and Hamdi Pasha had done." Likewise, Hassan Aga, an Arab Christian from Mersin, says to Tarishian, "Ever since I met you, I have loved you as my child." Tarishian also visits Hassan Aga and his family every Saturday evening during his military term in Mersin, apparently to give instruction in the Holy Bible, which actually, in the text, he says was written in classical Armenian, and this Arab Christian family had somehow gotten it during the massacres of 1909. They bought it for really cheap from somebody, so they have this Bible in the house, and they ask my great-grandfather to read it for them. So it's a very interesting and layered interaction. As he writes of this ritual, he writes, "I felt like a member of the family." Indeed, Tarishian even falls in love with the daughter of Hassan Aga, which he later seeks to justify in terms of a brother's love for his sister. Perhaps most compelling, Tarishian writes that his own father, Panos Tarishian, who's on the right, ran a successful barber shop in Marash in partnership with a Turk, Çelebi Hüseyin Aga. The two men, whom Tarishian notes worked together in quote brotherly fashion for over 30 years, were initially brought together by their respective fathers, who were also close friends. In a society centered on family relations, the existence of such intercommunal relationships expressed in the paramount terms of family must be recognized as highly meaningful acts of affiliation and should be analyzed accordingly. Indeed, Tricium's relationships with Turkish brothers and friends even resume after he has returned with his family from his deportation years in Syria. His father's Turkish business partners actually renders him his share of lost profits, and they resume barbering together. People described by Tricium as, quote, Turkish notables, even attend his wedding in 1919. These non-Armenian figures should be taken into account and acknowledged by modern historiography as they are by Tricium himself, as having been integral and fundamental to the life of a provincial Ottoman Armenian artisan. So as Sebo talked about earlier, the issue of language is also an extremely telling component of Tricium's memorial text. Tricium, who wrote his memoir in Armenian, was also a fluent speaker of Turkish, and much Turkish enters into the text. It is clear from his memoir that he valorizes both languages, Turkish and Armenian, positively, and he uses both as vehicles of his self-expression. They're both coming easily. This bilingualism and perhaps unexpected positive valorization is evidenced in exercise in countless places throughout the memoir. Perhaps nowhere is this done more tellingly and amusingly than in Tricium's transcription of a comic ritual performed nightly during his time as a soldier in the Ottoman army, in which the Armenian soldiers not only speak and understand Turkish and also some Arabic, but they know Turkish well enough to make fun of their Muslim Arab corporal for his poor Turkish. Indeed, the Armenian Christian soldiers elevate themselves over the Muslim Arab by virtue of their superior understanding of the Turkish language. So unfortunately, since the whole point of this account is to make fun of the Arab corporal's bad Turkish, which is presented as something between pidgin and gibberish with several Arabic words in the mix, the comic dialogue does not readily allow oral recitation or even translation, but I'm gonna provide an attempted translation and passage. So this image, actually, Baskin was posted it once, I took it. So besides me in the unit grouping, there were two Armenian reservists born in Adana. One was Setrak, the other was Manuk, named Saçci by the corporal, since Manuk was a watchmaker. Every evening after dinner, Manuk caused laughter, prompted by the corporal, entertaining the soldiers assembled around the dinner platter. To this day, I laugh when I recall that scene. So there's laughter, he's laughing, I love it. Upon my command, look, the soldier saluted, to which Corporal Naji responded with, Alaikum Salam. Manuk began his joke ordering. First, attention, obedience to the Padishah, 5 times prayer. Second, comrade to comrade, comrade like a pillar. I wavered, no, I moved, no. Comrade to comrade, comrade, I laugh like a goose, no. I speak, no, comrade to comrade. Third, I obeyed. Soldier's head not big, especially above me, I obey. Continuing his ordering, he would say, you know, compatriot, I have a father for him, no brains, no money, no love. You know what I did to his father? I did avaf, I sold him agav. But I have such a mother, not his mother, motherhood, stepmother. God curse you 1,000 times. His mother constantly does gear gear to his father. At this point, the soldiers could no longer hold back and would start laughing. Corporal Naji angrily hit the floor with his cap, exclaiming, is this military a joke? Then I don't want this duty. Manuk, the watchmaker, who was brazen, came out of the lineup and said, we don't want a corporal like you. We have come here to learn soldiering and not to hear his father, his mother. So to conclude with the memoir, I will read a short passage regarding Tricium's years as a deportee in Hamas, Syria, in which he provides a telling account of his relationship with members of a local Arab Muslim family, an analysis of which we will return to shortly. The text reads as follows. Without knowing about his background, I had rented half of the shop of 75-year-old Abdul Hamid, who had family ties with the Azam clan and who was loved by the populace. He had served as a sergeant in the army and spoke Turkish well. He gave half of the money he earned to the Armenian children left in the streets. Scores of such children died of hunger day after day at corners in the market. Mustafa Efendi, scion of the Azam clan and one of the wealthy men of Hama, was in the habit of visiting his sister's husband Abdul Hamid, my companion in the shop, after midday prayers on Fridays. I befriended him as of my first Friday at the shop. So this is just an image of a shop in Marash. The passages from Tricium's memoir quoted in this paper clearly speak from an Ottoman-Armenian existential space that has not been sufficiently analyzed or conceptualized. Tricium's narrative contradictions and complications show us an underrepresented world and worldview that I hope sheds new light on the possibilities for intercommunal interaction and complex identity production in late Ottoman provincial society. These passages and many others also bring to light a larger phenomenon evidenced by both Tricium and his associates in the memoir, what I'm calling provincial cosmopolitanism. I am proposing this term to characterize the condition where the various and diverse persons and communities, or the various personal and communal worlds, inhabiting the same local and provincial ecosystem, who had, for the main part, never lived in any place other than in these provincial locales, could not only interact, as they clearly do in Tertian's memoir, but also by means and virtue of their interacting in lived dispositions of openness and even some sort of supercommunal affinity, influence and inscribe one another. This provincial cosmopolitanism was not the self-evident cosmopolitanism offlouted of the great imperial port cities, major ports, crossroads of medium or long-distance trade or pilgrimage sites, nor was it necessarily limited to being a byproduct of the European missionary presence or of travel to Europe. Rather, it was a local cosmopolitanism, a lived disposition, affinity, and identity of individual persons and of collective groups that was the direct result of living in a demographically concentrated provincial urban environment in which individuals and groups of diverse and differentiated ethnic, linguistic, religious, and cultural composition were engaged in an ecosystem of interaction. With Sibyl Zendesek notes of the traders and migrants in 19th century Izmir, effectively the cosmopolitan port city par excellence, no less applies to the relatively stationary community of Tertian's provincial Marash, as well as the other provincial communities we encounter in his text, such as those of Adana, Mersin, Kesab, Zeytun, Hama, and Muhrada. She says, premised on diversity, the Ottoman social order allowed its subjects to preserve their identities and the differential customary rights, duties, and privileges associated with these identities. Together, they forged in Izmir a distinctive polyglot enclave marked by differences, but also conducive to creative forms of interdependence, exchange, and initiatives. I am suggesting that this mutually influencing and mutually inscribing ecosystem of interactions such as these gave rise not only in the port cities and capitals, but also in provincial areas, to dynamic, multifaceted, and complex Ottoman identities constituted by the aggregation and accommodation in a particular individual or group of differences which we might not today expect to be concurrently maintained in a single identity. Such interacting individuals, constituted and compelled by this provincial cosmopolitanism, were thus able to create and operate intercommunal networks, to which we are not currently privy in most accounts, that were fundamental to their lives as late Ottoman subjects. As such, these intercommunal networks should, in the degree and to the extent possible, be fundamental to the late Ottoman histories that we write. So if we now return to the passage regarding Tertian's deportation in Syria quoted earlier, it will be clear just how ingrained and integral this provincial cosmopolitanism in fact was to Tertian's life and behavior, to his lived Armenianness. During his deportation years, which saw the displacement and death of family members, friends, and compatriots at the hands of the late Ottoman state, Tertian could yet feel immediate friendship and affinity towards Muslim Arabs, and they towards him. He could positively valorize Ottoman military service in the proper speaking of Turkish, and he could trust a stranger, quote, without knowing about his background. This cosmopolitan constitution did nothing short of allow him to cultivate the relationships that in many ways governed the course of his final years in his native land. Thank you.